The privatisation blitzkrieg that put Australia on the path to economic disaster, and Kiwis see-through AUKUS Trojan horse, coming up on today's Citizens Report. Welcome to the Citizens Report for the 25th of April 2024. I'm Elisa Barwick. Joining me today is Citizens Party Research Director Robert Barwick. Welcome.
Thanks, Elisa. Anzac Day.
It is. And on today's show, we're going to be talking about the war front, but also firstly we will talk about the economic crisis Australia is in today, and we will show you the blueprint from whence that disaster came, namely the policy program of Jeff Kennett in Victoria, which laid the pathway for the rest of the country, and we'll show you who was behind that.
And what a finely coordinated attack it was on our country.
That's right. We're feeling the consequences to this day. And so then we're going to come back and talk about a conference that took place in New Zealand on AUKUS, of which Helen Clark, among others, made some very scathing remarks.
Well, they, just to foreshadow slightly, they have a slightly different position to stand in Australia because they are proud of their independent foreign policy. We don't have one. And they can therefore see how they're being drawn in to giving it up.
Mm.
And people like Helen Clark have come out speaking forcefully against it, and people need to see what she had to say.
It's a bit more stark in their particular context. So, but we can learn from it. Now, do hit the like button, share this as widely as you can, make a comment below, participate in all of the campaigns that we're doing. You can see various links in the information box if you're watching this on YouTube. And if you're watching it on Channel 31, I know there's a few out there, do contact us for more information. You can subscribe to our Australian Alert Service. You can also donate. There's a link below for that, which is crucial. That's the only way that we can continue to fight these fights we're taking on, which are targeted strategic fights, such as the one, and you might want to say a few words about it, that you've been participating in for the last 13 months, and that is the campaign to stop bank branch closures. And you were in Bribie Island last week, which we did report on the show. But what are your reflections now that the consultation process has come to an end? And, of course, on the 16th of May, the committee will be reporting, giving their recommendations for what should be done.
Yeah, well, it's really good to participate in a process like this. You see it yourself. You can absorb all the witness testimony. I think Senate inquiries are the very best part of Australia's parliamentary system.
Mm.
And the proof of that is the fact that Peter Van Onselen, speaking on behalf of Corporate Australia, has come out attacking them on last week, attacking Senate inquiries, saying that they're just a corporate bashing campaign. Well, some corporations, namely banks and big retail duopolies, etc., need to be bashed. And the crossbench in both the Senate and the House has grown because the two, I mean, think of it like this way, the two major parties, I can tell you what distinguishes them from the other parties is they are beholden to the vested interests, which are the corporations, right? And so they'll tell you what you want in opposition when they get into government. They just give the corporations what they want. So because of that, the public's become increasingly disenchanted, and so the primary vote for the two major parties has dropped to record lows. That's allowed a larger and larger crossbench to enter into Parliament. The existence of the crossbench has allowed greater and greater transparency into the parliamentary processes in the form of Senate inquiries. And Peter Van Onselen's lost it in the Australian a couple of weeks ago.
He says that parliamentary inquiries have become little more than a forum for fringe dwellers in the political system.
Well, as I say, Elisa, because the Citizens Party, has always been called the word fringe has always been used about us. I don't have a fringe. I've sacrificed my fringe to this cause, and this our efforts are paying off, right? So anyway, back to this particular one. Here's the thing that has to be reflected in the final report of this bank branch closures inquiry, that the testimony from one end of Australia to the other was universal with local characteristics. That's the point. And that fact alone proves the banks are a pack of liars. I tweeted in the middle of the Bribey Island hearing, I did this tongue-in-cheek tweet, Mr. Chairman, I move we suspend this hearing straight away until such time that you can force Anna Bly to come down here on behalf of the Banking Association and sit down and listen to this testimony.
Yeah.
Because they're not seeing the world in a different way. They don't have their own, it's not that they have their own perspective. They are liars. They do not care about the damage they are doing to these communities, but they've sold their agenda to the politicians by saying, oh, this is what the public want. No, the public had 13 opportunities to front up at hearings about this, and the public made it absolutely damn clear this is what they do not want. Now, will Matt Canavan's report reflect that truth? Because it can't do it in words, it has to do it in deeds. And the deeds are, at a minimum, some really tough actual regulations on the banks, really tough ones, and hopefully something really strong like a public bank, such as we're proposing as a postal bank, to actually give these big four banks their worst nightmare, a public competitor that'll force them to compete the way they've had to compete with Kiwi Bank in New Zealand.
Mm.
Anyway, so that's what we'll do. We'll keep on the subject, Elisa, but that's what it'll come down to.
Yeah. Now, you've been stirring things up on another front this week as well, and that is in relation to something that deserved to be absolutely provoked, and that is an article that came out on the 20th of April by Alan Howes. Alan Howe, Assange's sordid tale of treachery. This was a absolutely disgusting piece of, if you could call it journalism.
In
I think we should say Alan Howe's not a journalist.
Well, I think we should read the opening here. This is what he wrote in The Australian on last Saturday. Now, remember, Julian Assange right now is at the most vulnerable point in his legal battles with the UK and the United States, right? So the United States has come back with these so-called guarantees that the UK courts wanted. So in a coordinated way, the Murdoch media, and this is one of them, this is the one I took exception to, other Murdoch outlets did the same thing. In a coordinated way, the Murdoch media came out and launched attacks on Julian Assange. Now, can I say the Wall Street Journal reporter in Russia, Gersevich, who has been held up as an example of Russia's lack of freedom for the media, is also a Murdoch guy. The Wall Street Journal is Murdoch. And in 2019, the Wall Street Journal wrote an editorial about Assange saying that because of the damage he's done to US interests, he's fine when he got pulled out of the Ecuadorian embassy, he's finally one step closer to facing accountability in US courts. That's what they said. So sorry, I don't care about Mr. Gersevich, because the organisation he works for does not believe in press freedom, does not believe in transparency, because the proof is what they're doing to Assange. But in this particular case, Alan Howe wrote, Julian Assange is a criminal, a fabulist and an undisciplined, arrogant, work-shy fraud who lacks an education while remaining a mannerless vulgarian. The WikiLeaks founder is no journalist. In Assange's fantasy world, he is a warrior for justice. The truth is his WikiLeaks was a Trojan horse for hate. Assange did not set out to reveal what he believed to be the immoral, corrupt manner in which our allies in the West seek security in a dangerous world. Let me repeat that. He did not set out to reveal what he believed to be the immoral, corrupt manner in which our allies in the West seek security in a dangerous world. That's Alan Howe's language for war crimes. He wanted to strafe the foundations of the complex, sensitive, diplomatic communications that help keep us a step ahead of our enemies. His betrayals raise him into Treason's Hall of Fame alongside Norway's Nazi collaborator Vidkun Quisling, the gunpowder plots Guy Fawkes and Marshal Philippe Pétain, who led Vichy France. Et tu, Assange? No doubt. He is the Judas Iscariot of the digital age. When I read that, Elise, when I got tipped off by my friend Kim to read this, I saw red for two reasons. Not only is this absolute vile attack on a great Australian who is actually paying the price for his public service, but I knew about this guy because Back in the year, he was the editor of the Melbourne Herald Sun from the late mid-90s till about 2008 or 9 or something. And in those days, my job in the office here was to clip the newspapers, including his paper. And I saw what he was. I saw the kind of paper he ran, especially the Murdoch media at the time of the Iraq War, because that's what made Assange famous, what he exposed about the Iraq War, right? That's what really made him enemies. The Murdoch media at the time of the Iraq War, they didn't report on the Iraq War debate. They campaigned for the war. They're not a media organisation. They are an intelligence front. And this guy's Melbourne Herald Sun, people like him and his columnist Andrew Bolt, and they've never apologised to this day, they campaigned for the Iraq War. The blood of a million Iraqis is on their conscience, right? Now, he is living the life of luxury here in Victoria, right? While Assange is literally hasn't seen freedom for 9 years or whatever it is and has literally rotted in Belmarsh prison for five. And this guy thinks that he has the right to lick his boots, let alone write garbage like this.
And he tries to make out how wonderful Belmarsh prison is too, by the way.
So the reason he's actually written to Craig Isherwood and the chairman of our party, Ann Lawler, asking for me to be fired. Because I wrote this on Twitter. Because I had seen red. Now, I don't normally do this on Twitter. But when I know someone is irredeemably evil and they are perpetrating a great injustice, this is the sort of stuff that every now and then I will do. Nature throws up incredible mutations. In this instance, oozing pus from the anus of a badly infected warthog has combined with its foul diarrhea to produce a particularly vile mutant organism known by the name Alan Howe. Bizarrely, it speaks in the Murdoch gutter media. And Mr. Howe took exception to that.
If you think Robbie should be sacked, put a comment below.
And he wrote to the person he thinks is my boss, and I mean, he is our boss, really, but he's a nicer guy than that. He's the most long-suffering boss in history, the way we treat him. But anyway, he thinks that I should be fired over that because that is sordid compared to what he did to Julian Assange.
Yeah.
But the real issue here is the agenda of the Murdoch media. They are not a media organisation. They are not about reporting the news. Murdoch, for his whole history, Rupert Murdoch was trained by the people who set up British intelligence in Britain. They trained him. They trained his father, actually.
Personally.
Lord Northcliffe trained Murdoch's father, Keith Murdoch, and Lord Beaverbrook trained Rupert Murdoch. And he has run an intelligence front his whole life called News Corp, right? That's who this guy is. And when it matters, he makes sure the Anglo-American war machine get their wars, get their regime change, and keep us all stupefied into accepting this. Mm. Julian Assange came along and came up with a website that actually showed that these people are liars. It's not just that the government are liars. The media that covered for
Absolutely.
Them all are liars.
Yeah.
That's why they hate him. That's why they despise him. And my last message to Alan Howe is this. Crawl on your belly to the Middle East and ask forgiveness for the million people who are dead for the war you campaigned for. And I may take down that tweet.
But probably not. Now, speaking of intelligence, security, the whole apparatus, and what people have seen in the media yesterday in terms of AFP raids and so forth, and, of course, recent events in Australia leading up to this point, did you want to say a word about the misinformation, disinformation bill?
Yes, so, and there's going to be a lot more on this, but just to foreshadow it. So, last year, the exposure draft consultation process of the government's misinformation, disinformation bill, which we described as Orwellian, and people are probably very familiar with it now. Everything is misinformation, disinformation, except what comes from the government, right? It's straight out of 1984. This got such enormous blowback across the board. The Human Rights Council, everybody, Law Foundation, you know, the government withdrew it and took it back to the drawing board. It's almost as if they've been sitting there waiting for a trigger to bring it back. And the trigger was the terrible stabbing of the Assyrian bishop in Sydney. Now, you know, we have, one of our colleagues is an Assyrian, right? We have direct information about this kind of thing. They've seized on this, called it a terrorist attack, even though he's a 16-year-old boy. Many people in the Assyrian community don't consider it a terrorist attack. They see it as a deranged young man committing a knife crime, right? But they've held all this stuff ready to go and roll it out, right? And including misinformation, disinformation. And you can see the big public spat between, you know, Albanese and Elon Musk and all that sort of stuff. A lot of which is for show, probably. The fact that they've seized on this to ram this bill again, right, is the way they usually do. They're always looking for a pretext. So we will go hard on it, and we'll provide the details, because they haven't put the bill into Parliament yet, but expect that pretty soon, I imagine, the way they're talking. Mm. And as usual, Peter Dutton has offered bipartisanship. And when they do that, that's where the evil really does lie. When the two major parties combine, that's when you're dealing with some nasty agendas.
Yep, so we'll be talking more about this subject in the coming weeks. Now, you can hear Robbie talk more about these subjects Saturday night, 5 p.m. on TNT Internet Radio.
Yeah, I'll be on the Jason Olborne show on, if you're familiar with TNT, Saturday night at 5 p.m. for an hour. Also, Lisa, the following Tuesday at 8 p.m, I'll be live on Martin North's live show, Digital Finance Analytics, or on the Walk the World channel. Look that up, Walk the World, Martin North, and I'll be live on that.
And our final plug before we get into the first topic. We, the Citizens Party, have been holding forums around the country. We'll put a link below where you can find out how you can come along and participate. The upcoming ones in April, May, June are taking place in Victoria, New South Wales and Western Australia, so particularly if you're in those states, have a look. All right. The privatisation blitzkrieg that put Australia on the path to economic disaster. So,
Can I say something before you do? You've done an enormous amount of work on this, so I think you need to do most of the talking. I just want to set the scene about we're dealing with, people need to appreciate how much we're dealing with the legacy of this today. Mm. Before Kennett and before, and Paul Keating actually federally had started privatising as well, but what Kennett did was such a specifically planned, coordinated thing, and it was such an enormous privatisation program. Australians didn't think in terms of privatising. Governments had assets. I'll give you one example. If you governments own public housing, for instance, and if you needed more public housing, they built it. They didn't come up. They didn't say, "Oh, we need to incentivise the public the private sector to do this." No, they just did it, and that's why we didn't have unaffordable housing for decades and decades and decades and decades. Whereas now we've become used to unaffordable housing. And the other one is I'll just mention is the banks. We don't have any public banks anymore because these bastards privatised them all. And that's why we have arrogant banks that think they can just rip the guts out of communities all around Australia. And they dismantled, Elisa, the way government, the very function of government, the competence of government. Yeah. Because suddenly, governments can't make decisions anymore. Let's get PwC, let's get, McKinsey. Let's get consultants. You know, we'll sack 1,000 public servants who are costing us $1 million, and we're going to $1 million a week, and we're going to replace them with, we'll get these consultants. They're really smart people, and they're going to cost us $5 million a week, right? But they can make the decisions for us, right? And all this stuff started with this thing that you're about to go through.
And by the way, on that exact subject, I do have another plug. Listen to the podcast between Anthony Plann and Professor Andy Schmulo. It's called Corporate Grime. It's excellent. And in one of those, he talks about exactly this. He talked about the competence of the public sector and how that was just demolished and ripped apart. And then, you know, the lowest paid PwC or corporate sector worker was paid more than the highest paid public servant. So a lot of good details there. But we call this a blitzkrieg very specifically and precisely because, look, when Kennett came in, everything, all his policies were pre-baked, ready to take out of the oven and put straight on the table in front of everybody.
And they move fast.
They move very fast. So Kennett was elected on the 6th of October 1992. Within 3 weeks, he had legislation passed. Now, and this is also the lead up to Christmas where very little happens, October, November, December. In that short period of time, The Industrial Relations Act 1979 was repealed in its entirety and replaced with the Employee Relations Act 1992 to deregulate labour markets completely, including for the public sector.
And essentially to weaken the ability of organised labour to stop
to block
the rest
it.
Of what he
yeah,
was trying
exactly.
to do.
Yeah, exactly. So that happened within 3 weeks of the date he was elected. Amazing. Like, what government comes in and delivers on their promises within 3 weeks? That just doesn't happen. In November, so the month after he was elected, they passed the State-Owned Enterprises Act 1992, which removed state-owned enterprises from any parliamentary purview and gave the executive of the government the final say in order to pave the way for full privatisation.
So every asset, and this is what he... In the 90s, the two biggest privatisation programs were Russia and Victoria. Russia was probably larger, Victoria was quicker.
Mm.
And it was because of that. Parliament did not have to approve each sale.
Mm.
Jeff Kennett approved each
sale.
Yeah,
exactly.
Bang, 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 bang.
And what the first thing that this new act set up was corporatisation of government entities to prepare them for privatisation. And this enabled a few things. It allowed commercial in confidence clauses to be invoked, which allowed Kennett to keep the whole process secret. Nothing
yep.
could be revealed because it was commercial in confidence, because these entities were corporatised.
And Elisa, again, this is why we're refocusing on this. This was the beginning of this commercial in confidence garbage, where now almost everything government does is kept secret because so much of what they do is public-private partnerships. They say, oh, that's commercial in confidence. That's commercial in confidence. You can't know.
Now, it also allowed this corporatisation, allowed removal of cross-subsidies within these agencies, which are also something that it comes up today in regard to Australia Post. You can't have cross-subsidisation.
Well, I've got another example I wanted to interrupt with on that one as well.
Okay, and the other thing is community service obligations, because community service obligations meaning that...
They allowed them to remove those as well.
They allowed them to remove those. They were blamed for inefficiencies because it is not necessarily profitable to provide services to people who are in regional areas or people who... can't necessarily, because they might be disabled, they can't access things, or the poorer people who can't afford things, so you might have to subsidise them.
So my example, Elisa, is that in 1992, the Productivity Commission, which is the mother load of neoliberalism in Australia, they put out a report to help give cover to what Kennett was going to do. And it was a report into Australia's electricity system.
Mm.
And they had three criticisms of our electricity system. Three. One of them was not pricing. They acknowledged that our electricity was among the cheapest in the world, right? It wasn't pricing.
Mm.
They criticised there was excess capacity, i.e. we produced more electricity than we needed. Shock, horror. One problem. The second problem was gross overstaffing. They employed more people than they needed to, you know, including a lot of electrician apprentices, right? That's who they employed, right? Gross overstaffing. Even though we still had the cheapest power in the world, we had gross overstaffing. And the third was cross subsidies. The people in regional towns paid a cent a kilowatt less because the people in cities paid a cent a kilowatt more, right? Because, you know why? The power lines in cities are shorter per capita than the longer power lines in the country. So your country cousin got affordable electricity because you paid a slight amount more. And that's a cross-subsidy, and that's evil to neoliberals. And they said, see, we've got to corporatise it and privatise it. And Kennett said, thank you very much, I'll do that. Now, before you go on, who would not trade our current electricity system today for that one that was criticised by the Productivity Commission in 1992? Excess power, plenty of people employed, and cheaper electricity in the country.
Well, Victoria now has the highest power prices in the world, if you can compare it with other states. Now, in that, and I'll just add that all of those reforms were about making these agencies that they were going to privatise, making them, increasing their commercial viability,
yes,
right?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
So keep that in mind. But within those 3 months, October, November, December 1992. So they passed those two bills that I mentioned. Then they passed the Public Sector Management Act 1992 to prepare the way to outsource the public service. And just within the first 3 years of Kennett being in power, I mean, straight away they cut the number of government departments from 22 down to 15, slashed 50,000 public service jobs, and of course then went on to outsource a lot of government activity, which, you know, included, I mean, privatisation of speed cameras, things like that, outsourcing of fire management, Justice Department and police functions,
and I have another actual example that I know that illustrates that. So we used to have in Victoria Public Works Department, and I knew about the department and Kennett privatising it, but I was the president of the local primary school and worked closely for a couple of years, worked closely with the principal. And the school roof was leaking. And back in the day, this principal would have been able to call up the education department, say the roof is leaking. The education department would call the public works department. The public works department would send around people to fix the roof. She couldn't do that. She had to go into the marketplace. Now, there were agents to help her do this. So she had to contact an agent who booked the roof repair people, and she'd done this. They repaired the roof. They didn't do a good job. That agent, though, was no help to her because the people he subcontracted to, they'd gone out of business, and he was saying, so they're not obliged to come back and repair the roof. And this went on, and this was taking up the principal of the school's time instead of educating kids. That agent used to work for the public works department before it was privatised, right? And it's the sort of, so here's a public service, the education of children being caught up in an inefficient process because of what Kennett did.
All the competitive tendering and all of that was part of this whole mix. Now, the reason it could be all brought in so quickly, though, was because, as I said, it had all been pre-scripted. In general, think tanks had written the script for this a long, long time earlier.
They scoped it right out.
And this is coming from the international umbrella think tank called the Mont Pelerin Society, formed right after World War II, but which operated here in Australia through local agencies. And the Institute for Public Affairs and the Tasman Institute here had written a program 1 year earlier called The group was called Project Victoria. Their report was called Victoria, an Agenda for Change. And we wrote about this when Kennett was in power, of course. And, of course, the thing is, it's dawning on people now when they look at the state of this region of Australia, exactly what that meant. And, of course, all the rest of the state governments and at the federal level followed suit very rapidly. And the people that ran the project, I mean, Michael Porter ran Project Victoria with Des Moore. Porter worked at the IMF and the US Federal Reserve and the Reserve Bank of Australia. He was an insider to federal and state governments. Des Moore spent 3 decades at the Federal Treasury and, incidentally, was a member of the inaugural council of ASPI, Australian Strategic Policy Institute. So it's all part of the same nest of individuals diverting the course of this country away from sovereignty, which includes economic sovereignty.
And it was so revealing, though, that they called themselves Project Victoria. Mm. They had a project for this state, and what they were doing was using this state as the guinea pig for the whole country.
That's right. Now, a part of the speed with which this was done was possible because of the preparatory work that had gone on in terms of propaganda. You know, putting the word out that the Labor government that preceded Jeff Kennett had been responsible for this incredible explosion of debt, et cetera, et cetera. And this was all propaganda in the media through all of our favourite journalists. We should look back and check what Alan Howe had to say.
The Melbourne Herald. The Melbourne Herald was one of them. Murdoch then as well was the big one.
Yeah. But there were... So Kennett had 7... quote-unquote, crisis budgets in his first 3.5 years. So they were able to do this because of that the groundwork had been laid. One of the things that paved the pathway was an independent commission of audit. And I read a book, a series of essays recently, which sparked me off on doing this series, in which David Hayward, who's at RMIT University, wrote that this commission of audit, he said, was both partial, meaning of a party favour.
It was biased.
And highly inconsistent. It went to great lengths to estimate the value of state debt, but made only the most flimsy attempt to estimate the value of state assets. Debt had started rising in the last 3 years of the Labor government preceding Kennett because of an economic recession, which followed the explosion of a financial asset bubble through the 1980s and, of course, erupted with the collapse of 1987 and sparking and leading into that 1990s recession, which was left out of the equation in all this propaganda. And the claim that was made by Kennett and Co and by this particular commission of audit that Victoria was spending more on debt than any other state, that same claim was true of the time of the year when Labor had come into office as well, when that Labor government...
So it was always true. Under the previous Liberals, Victoria was also spending more on debt than any other state.
That's right. So the way that it was played up made it out that this was a Labor problem. We'll show at this point, let's watch this ad and you see the absolute beating of the drum that went on. This is actually a 1996 re-election campaign, but it was the same slogan and imagery that was used when Jeff Kennett got elected in 1992.
It was a famous one.
Remember the mess the Labor Party left behind? Remember Labor's pyramid scandal? Labor's transport chaos? Labor's sell-off of her own bank? Remember Labor's budget blowout that almost bankrupted Victoria? Same people, same policies, same guilty party. Authorised Piper Jolly, Liberal Party, Melbourne.
Yeah, so they come up with this line, the guilty party, right? And they flogged it to death in 1992 and they rehashed it in 1996. Because by then, though, they were starting to become the guilty party because of what they were implementing so quickly with this Project Victoria agenda.
Exactly. Now, so in addition to that, you had rating agencies weighing in, as they do today, saying, you know, government's got to get the debt under control. You had the private sector think tanks, which put out these reports, including Project Victoria and others, that were supposedly, you know, objective, unbiased reports. And, of course, they absolutely were not. The other thing that I want to mention, and I wrote a whole article on this section of it, is the role of the collapse of Tricontinental, which was this merchant, Australia's biggest and largest, or first and largest merchant banking operation, because this contributed a huge amount to the state debt, because the State Bank of Victoria, the State Savings Bank, took it over. And the reason for that was financial deregulation. So financial deregulation was being brought in at the federal level, opening the sluice gates for banks that would normally just take deposits, and including the State Bank of Victoria, to start doing much more complicated investment-type activities and merchant banking activities. Now, this had actually started in the 1970s under the Victorian Liberal government of Sir Rupert Hamer, and the act that governs the State Bank of Victoria was amended in the 1970s on a number of occasions to allow the State Bank to start to do things like engaging in the short-term money market, investing in bills of exchange, and expanding into merchant banking. And so in 1975, the State Bank made the mistake of buying a 25% share of Westralian, a Perth-based merchant bank, so that it could have someone with experience to launch its merchant banking operations. Unfortunately, that company went bad and merged with Tricontinental in 1978. And so the State Bank basically had an arrangement then, an ownership in Tricontinental, which it wasn't planning on. But then the following year in 1979, the Campbell Inquiry started in Australia and the sluice gates were open, and Tricontinental started, it became the first a big Australian player in the futures and derivatives markets. And its clientele was who? Alan Bond, Christopher Skase. This intersected the, you know, incredible flourishing of speculation throughout this country, which by 1987, you know, imploded on themselves. And at that point, the State Bank had actually been trying to offload Tricontinental for a while, but at that point it was forced to absorb Tricontinental and all of its speculative losses. And so the state of Victoria was absolutely in the you-know-what.
And Alyssa, why this is important is I've had politicians, even recently, in federal parliament argue with me, oh, we can't go back to public banks. They were a disaster. Look at the Victorian State Bank. Look at the South Australian State Bank.
Yep.
Here were banks that had lasted 100 years, right? Perfectly fine. I think you've got some stuff on what it used to do. It was not that they existed as state banks. It's that they, in the mania about the rise of merchant banking starting in the late 70s, right, and speculation, stupid politicians, starting with the Liberal Party, actually, as you said, allowed these public institutions to be caught up in that. They were never there they should never have been allowed to compete with the private sector on that stuff. And what we're proposing, they never would be, right? Go back to doing the things that they used to do, which was incredibly valuable and made them incredibly safe.
So the State Bank of Victoria, the State Savings Bank, was the biggest home lender in Victoria. But it didn't just lend the money for the loans, and I'm going to write more about this in the Alert Service next week, because it's a fascinating story. They built the houses. I mean, the bankers didn't go out there and lay the bricks, but they had
their own division that made sure it happened.
Yeah, they got the contracts. They oversaw the contracts. They actually went on site and inspected the work, which was done according to legally fixed standards of construction. I mean, if only we had this today when you drive past a new house that's being built and look at the standards of them and how quickly they fall apart afterwards.
And this became a brand of quality for construction.
I can put up a little ad which I went looking on Trove for, because I was reading a report of one of the former heads of the State Bank, or not the very head, but head of one of the home building departments, and he said it was a real badge of honour that when you put an ad to sell your home, you put in there, built under bank supervision. And the thing is, it was the fact that the state government went into this was based on the demand for housing loans and the demand for housing. If you think about it today, we've got incredible demand. What, you know, look at that demand as an opportunity to fill a gap in the market. And so what they did, the way they funded it, is the State Bank had what's called credit foncier loans, which is a fancy way of saying a basic fixed term, long-term loan. But it was backed by the equivalent of state government bonds. So it was effectively government guaranteed. So they created credit because they're a bank, they can do that. Yeah. And they also put out loans from their savings bank department. But at that time, of course, you know, the cost of the home was about three times the income of people. So if you think about that today, if we were to set up such a mechanism, and, you know, the number of houses they were able to build because they had standard models and you could choose from a certain number of models, they had all of the inputs and everything required streamlined to lay them out fast, and they did an excellent job.
And all this is what we've lost, right? So we've focused on the Victorian part because we're talking about the Kennett Project, because the Kennett Project was the hardest, most ruthless, most rapid privatisation program in world history, what he did. Like I said, the only thing that was bigger than it was what happened in Russia, but that took over 10 years. This was done in 3 years or so. They used the excuse of debt. Actually, the only country we sort of lagged behind was the Kiwis. They started their privatisation program first. Their Kennett, a guy named Roger Douglas, he actually admitted later on, he said that debt was just a pretext. It was never about paying off debt.
Exactly, right? Same.
So they used the excuse of debt. What they did is, Kennett claimed to have paid off the debt. What he actually did by selling the biggest asset was the electricity system. He transferred Victoria's $30 billion estate debt onto these private companies that bought the electricity system. So they borrowed to buy the electricity system. So the $30 billion was on their books, and we, the Victorian electricity consumers, were paying in our electricity prices what those companies needed to make a profit, and repay their debt. Yeah. So we were still, the people were still saddled with the debt.
For sure.
Right? But the Victorian government wasn't.
And the government lost a revenue stream of $1.7 billion per year estimated
exactly.
at that time.
And these revenue streams are incredibly valuable. Mm. And so what Kennett sort of came through like a battering ram and did with this careful, it's a blitzkrieg, a carefully coordinated, like they planned it years in advance and they did it so quickly, then that normalised it for everybody else.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's been very few, you know, Queensland still has state-owned electricity assets because by the time they got around to talking about it, the Queensland people were able to learn from what happened in Victoria and say, hell no, this ain't going to happen, right? And the whole country needs to learn from that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, now let's move on. Kiwis see through AUKUS Trojan horse. So there was an extraordinary event, Robbie, on the 18th of April held in the New Zealand Parliament in which former Prime Minister Helen Clark spoke. She was the star of the show, in our opinion. But you had Bob Carr from Australia
there too,
who made a great contribution, and others. So
the thing is, it was about AUKUS because New Zealand is now being drawn into what they call AUKUS Pillar 2 along with the Japanese. So AUKUS is Australia, United Kingdom, United States. That's the nuclear submarines project. Bob Carr. I mean, I'm used to Bob Carr. That's why we're not going to play a clip from Bob Carr. But the Kiwis were really impressed with him because Bob Carr said, this whole thing is BS. Everything you're being told is garbage. He did not hold back. He was quite forceful. But Helen Clark, I think, gave a very profound contribution. And the reason why is this, and it's what Australians need to think about when we consider ourselves and our smaller cousins across the ditch, whose name's actually in our constitution, by the way. It was a quirk of history. They're not part of Australia. But thank God they're not, because as terrified as we are by the supposed threats we face in our part of the world, they're not. Why are we under threat, but the Kiwis aren't? Mm. And we're going to play a clip. You'll see Helen Clark express this. In 1986, New Zealand broke from the ANZUS Treaty. And the ANZUS Treaty is mostly a myth anyway. Like it was a formal treaty, but unlike, say, NATO, the NATO Treaty, America is not if we're attacked or New Zealand's attacked under ANZUS, America was not obliged to come to our rescue. It was obliged to consult with us. That's all it said, right? But New Zealand decided in 1986 that they did not want a part of the escalation of proliferation of nuclear weapons. So they adopted a anti-nuclear weapons policy. And after that, they said to the Americans, you can't bring in your nuclear-powered ships here. And David Longie stared Reagan down, and New Zealand was basically out of ANZUS from that moment on. And New Zealand has enjoyed being out of ANZUS. New Zealand has enjoyed its independence. We don't have independence. I became friends with Malcolm Fraser in his final years. He wrote the definitive book on it, Dangerous Allies. He said, we've never had independence in this country. We've always been either subservient to the United Kingdom or the United States. We are not an independent country. New Zealand has had 40 years of independence. But this, now that America is trying to go to war with China, which is our part of the world, no country is being allowed to keep its independence, right? But so the Kiwis, starting with Jacinda Ardern, Saint Jacinda, you know, on the international stage, she presented herself as a saintly person. On the domestic stage, that's why she bowed out early. She was going to be voted out. It would not have looked good for her rep, right? Because she started the rot of drawing New Zealand back into the nuclear umbrella, which was against New Zealand policy, and now her successor, Christopher Luxon, is now talking about New Zealand becoming part of AUKUS Part 2. Mm. But the New Zealanders, because they have this sense of independence, they have got much greater clarity on this than we do. And before we play the clip, though, I want to remind people something about, which we wrote about it in the Alert this week. I want to remind people something happened to Helen Clark. We're not going to play this part, but she talked about the Iraq War, and she talked about how New Zealand did not want a part of the Iraq War.
Mm.
And they made it clear to the Australians, to John Howard and George Bush, we're not having a part of it. This is us making a sovereign, independent decision. No way. Now, that did not look good for the cause at the time, right? And believe me, our side took it personally. After the invasion, which was March 2003, a few months later, Helen Clark was coming through Australia, just transiting on her way. She was actually, they had sent troops to Afghanistan, but they regarded Iraq as very different. And she, her plane landed, she was on a commercial plane, it landed. She was greeted by an Australian government official. So the Australian government knew she was coming. Later on, this became an issue because the Australian government claimed they didn't know. So here she is, the Prime Minister of Australia, she's queuing off the plane, and someone in customs had the job of randomly picking people from the plane to run this explosion detection device, which was sort of an invasive thing, over their body. But it was a random thing. Didn't do it with everybody, just randomly. That person picked the Prime Minister of New Zealand to take a side and run this device over her body. And afterwards, the Australian government said, oh, no, no, we don't apologise for our security measures. Believe me, the Kiwis knew what it was. It was a big middle finger from Australia to the Kiwis for daring to buck the system. And at that time, we hadn't quite been humiliated yet because we were still believing there were weapons of mass destruction, right? Helen Clark said in this thing, she said it was the best, one of the best decisions New Zealand has ever made. This is what New Zealand experienced to, and her personally, to stick with this independent position. So now she's watching her country being drawn back, not only into AUKUS, but into a nuclear thing, which is the cornerstone of their foreign policy, their anti-nuclear weapons, right? So she came out and she did not hold back. I just found her so precise, so clear. She even, we're not playing this bit, but she even ridiculed the claim that the Chinese had hacked the New Zealand Parliament. Like, we hear this garbage all the time, and both sides of politics take this so seriously. The only political party that doesn't is us. We are laughing our heads off it all the time. It is made up garbage, people. Every time you hear it, laugh. It's garbage. Well, go and watch the speech yourself. We'll put it below. The New Zealand Prime Minister, her words were, it was gratuitous, right? Like, they're not idiots. They're thinking, cut that garbage out. Right, we're not falling for your rubbish. You create the threat that then, oh, we're the big solution to, right? So the great clarity on that. But then she talked about the part we're going to play, and it's 5.5 minutes, so, but it's worth watching. She goes through, from the standpoint, they're clearly committed to an independent foreign policy, or they were, but then she says, she describes what she calls slippage. So it's worth having a look.
New Zealand hitherto has carefully balanced its positioning, making it clear always what its values and views are, and pursuing its economic interests. But as I said, there has been slippage. If I think back to my time as Prime Minister, we never conceded the existence of the Five Eyes Agreement. Well, fast forward to now, statements are put out on it by finance ministers. It seems to somehow define what we speak on and what we don't on so many occasions. That's a worry. Officialdom quickly embraced the Indo-Pacific phraseology. Well, it goes without saying, New Zealand doesn't have an Indian Ocean frontage. We've always thought of ourselves as Asia-Pacific, a Pacific Rim country. And the reframing clearly has a geopolitical significance. I am, all for building New Zealand bilateral ties with India, but it is surely not an either-or. In May last year, May 31st, a joint statement came following the Jacinda Ardern-Joe Biden meeting at the White House. And in it, it noted, quote, a shared commitment among New Zealand and AUKUS partners to the peace and stability of the Indo-Pacific region. I noted at the time that the statement didn't appear to have had close scrutiny by New Zealand. It saw New Zealand buying into the US framing of the region, and also in saying that AUKUS was positive for the region, when the purpose, as has become very, very clear, is to amplify a nuclear submarine presence in the region, including by Australia. And it goes without saying that under New Zealand's current nuclear-free policy, Australia's nuclear-powered submarines could not sail into New Zealand ports. So prima facie, this raises some questions. In August last year, the then government released defence policy and security strategy documents which named China as, quote, the major driver for the new era of strategic competition among states, end quote, and noted in a somewhat breathless fashion that China was growing and modernising its military and increasingly able to project military and paramilitary force beyond its immediate region. Hello, China is a major power in our region. The US is a major power in our region. Our job, if we're maintaining an independent foreign policy, is to navigate both relationships and not act in ways which support polarisation and support a view that one side is driving tensions. Then there was the naming of China as being behind a hacking of the New Zealand parliamentary computers 3 years ago, a statement choreographed with US and UK statements about hacking. This was gratuitous. As Richard Preville pointed out in the Herald yesterday, there are no state secrets on the parliamentary computer. We're an open book around here. And now there's the firming up of the position on AUKUS, with the New Zealand Foreign Minister and US Secretary of State pronouncing from Washington, D.C. last week that the two countries see, quote, powerful reasons for New Zealand engaging practically with AUKUS. None, of course, were elaborated. And then the Prime Minister reported in The Australian last week saying that, quote, AUKUS is very good for our region. Well, again, not any specific reason for that given. And prior to all this, there was the joint ministerial meeting in Canberra, which went down a similar track and even invoked ANZUS as a living engagement, notwithstanding the operational exclusion of New Zealand from it since 1986. All of these statements being made about AUKUS being good for us are highly contestable. What is good about joining a ratcheting up of tensions in our region? Where is the military threat to New Zealand? What does AUKUS Pillar 2 actually offer New Zealand that it needs for its own defence? Do we really need access to quantum technology for military purposes and offensive cyber weapons capacity and hypersonic weapons? Might this just be a bit out of our league? Do we want to invest immensely more in defence to have such capacities? And if so, why? There is no doubt in my mind that if the drift we see in positioning continues, we will be positioned in a way we haven't been for some four decades, as a fully signed up partner to US strategies in the region. And from that, in my experience, would flow expectations about what is the appropriate level of defence expenditure for New Zealand and expectations of New Zealand contributing to more and more military activities.
So, Lisa, the other thing I liked about what she said is going after this term Indo-Pacific. Mm. I mean, this is what I loved about this speech. All the things, our party's actually published this relentlessly for 5 years. We've been taking these, all these claims, you know, cyber attacks. Yeah, prove it. And then the propaganda language, Indo-Pacific. Just, if you're old enough, just think, you didn't grow up hearing this term. Mm. You started hearing it 5 years ago because the Americans said, we're going to white out Asia. We're going to call it the Indo-Pacific now. And Helen Clark goes, what is this thing?
Yeah.
We don't front the Indian Ocean, right? Indo-Pacific as a region of the world is two-thirds of the damn globe. Yeah, and it is a globe, in case you don't know. Two-thirds is Indo-Pacific. That's not a region. It's an American propaganda term. In fact, Richard Braden wrote a couple of years ago, a Nazi first invented it for their purposes back in the 30s. But anyway, put that aside. And so she took that to task as well, right? See, in other words, this is why they see it's a Trojan horse, or people like her see it's a Trojan horse. And hopefully by her being so outspoken, the Kiwis, who are proud of their independence, who aren't cowering in fear about China, the Kiwis will see, oh, yeah, what are we being talked into doing here? And of course, the best part is those series of questions she asked. Where is the threat? Mm. And that's true for Australia as well. Where is, Paul Keating said this, we've been saying it all along. This is not, I mean, this is not 100 years ago. Where is this so-called threat? I grew up being told we're going to be invaded by Indonesia, right? My father grew up being told that the domino effect was going to come down if we didn't win the Vietnam War. Mm. And it was, none of it was ever true. All these things were pretexts for war. And now here you've got, and again, we didn't play this bit, but Helen Clark was saying, look, there's various aspects to security. One of them is economic security. Mm. And she pointed out that China is their best customer. And the when they lost their markets to the British, when the British joined the European Union, they had to find other markets. China is their best customer, like China is our best customer. And we're talking about our best customer as if it's a grave threat to us, right? And then as you see, she's saying, look, it's not up to us. Yes, China's a major power. The United States is a major power. Let's treat them equally. Let's not get drawn into this polarisation stuff, picking sides, etc. And Australia should have exactly the same view. Calm the hell down. But hopefully she'll be able to stop New Zealand making a mistake before it goes into this. We've already made a very expensive mistake. Can we stop it before, one, we bankrupt ourselves? Because we'll forget our sovereignty. We've lost that. One, we bankrupt ourselves, and two, we destroy ourselves in a war of annihilation. That's the issue. And thank God, share this around. Let people see how the Kiwis see the world and say, why don't we see the world that way?
Let's take a leaf out of their book on this one. So, yeah, that's it for the show this week. You can find out more by contacting us to get the alert service, subscribing, donating. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, Robbie.
Thanks, Lisa.
We'll see you again next week.
Authorised by Robert Bowick, Citizens Party, Melbourne.